For everyone who doesn't follow Devil We Know on social media yet, do it. Also, here's an important announcement. As of this week, Devil We Know would like to welcome Amanda from the State of Perfect Balance podcast to be a permanent part of our team. From now on, you'll have two awesome hosts sharing the stories that chill you to your bones. Look out, world. The Dual Narrative podcast is here. Fear it, love it, and listen for more.
You are listening to Devil We Know, a true crime podcast, which may contain adult themes, explicit language, and graphic depictions of violence. Portions of this show may be traumatic for those under 18. Listener discretion is advised.
In this episode of Devil We Know, a man in his 20s fosters romantic relationships with two people in their old age, with the ultimate goal of killing them for a hefty inheritance.
So I'm killing this man. Is it infanticide? Fantasize about it since the faggot tried to go against me. And now it's time for a crimson tide. And I'm the king. And I will reside on the throne. And you know that I will kill this guy.
On a cold January night, Peter Anthony Scott Farquhar was born in Edinburgh in 1946. Peter was the sort that maintained an intellectual interest for all of his life. His father was a general physician, so the encouragement for schooling was paramount to Peter. As such, he spent time attending some of the best schools available, nurturing a strong love for literary pursuits. From Latmere Upper School in West London to Churchill College at Cambridge, Peter studied English and literature at great lengths. Even as he went on to teach at Manchester Grammar School and then at Stowe, an independent school in Stowe, England, Peter passionately pursued literature in other ways. Namely, he had written on his own time, even finishing a novel manuscript in 1997 titled A Wide, Wide Sea. Farquhar's approach to teaching was often compared to that of the inspiring mentors of Hollywood, such as John Keating, the iconic English teacher in Dead Poets Society. As such, his teaching inspired the approach of many a boy in his classes. He seemed to understand them to a great degree, and his novel was one latent proof of such a powerful grasp on the mindset of male youth. That same enthusiasm was something that translated over to his work after he left Stowe and began giving occasional lectures at Cambridge University, starting in 2007. One friend and former pupil of Peter's, Michael Crick, even described Peter as having an acute understanding of the problems of modern adolescent boys. For some, he became almost like a second father. Perhaps it was this zeal that bled into the crowd at his lectures, encouraging many young students to approach him socially. These solicitations were usually welcome, of course. Peter was a social animal, and an intellectual at that. He lived to impart wisdom, and so when Benjamin Field and Martin Smith came to him and became acquainted with the learned writer, nothing at all seemed out of sorts for quite some time. For the elderly gentleman, it was likely that the newfound attention from these two young men helped him feel a little less lonely. Now, up in years, Peter had never truly settled down. One may have said he was married to his career, but there was more to it. Peter struggled with a belief in Christian theology and his feelings of attraction toward men, something that embattled his theology quite a bit. It became such an integral part of his inward struggle that his first ever published novel, Between Boy and Man, takes on those feelings of conflicted attraction and embodies them in the struggles of his fictional school chaplain, a story based loosely on Peter's own experiences while at Stowe. It was this feeling, perhaps, of loneliness and misunderstanding that made him incredibly welcoming to the two boys who, at some time after making his acquaintance, decided to move in with him. Ben and Martin even discovered a manuscript of Peter's, the tucked away copy of A Wide, Wide Sea, and read through it. They pushed for Peter to publish it, and they made other appeals of trust toward the man, whose desire to be seen had been fulfilled at long last, or so he thought. Ben and Martin spent a lot of time with Peter, and it was clear that the two had a lot to gain from it. They were able to receive years of wisdom from an acquaintance, dare they say, even a friend, whose experience had amounted to more than twice that of their own. Ben, a prolific writer in his own right, also stood to gain the rubbing of shoulders while he got to know Peter. And both Ben and Martin were rightly aware of the vast pension still trickling out of the sextagenarian. Both Ben and Martin were staying with Peter now, and Peter's relationship with Ben soon grew into a romantic entanglement. Ben had told Peter that he was apparently through with girlfriends, although he still was spending time with women on the side. However, Peter's repressed feelings were much more easily manipulated by Ben once they began sleeping together, and Ben even wrote an email before nurturing this relationship, detailing his intentions to wrest from Peter any rewards he could in a most sinister way.
Peter A. Scott Farquhar is a man of many contradictions. He is a closeted Christian, homosexual, English teaching pedant with a serious problematic attraction to teens, and who continues to privately tutor 14 and 15-year-old boys in his home. I do not suspect him of ever acting inappropriately in any way. This is because I know he is a virgin. I first met Peter in my sixth term of university. Peter usually acts in a fashion that betrays his fearful nature, overcautious and aged. Example, when making a cup of tea, he will go throw the bag into the cup, but is then stricken by apprehension and goes to toss the thing several times before dropping it from a distance of 3 to 5 inches. It's small, but summarizes his entire demeanor. Desiring to appear masterful, he contemplates showmanship. His aversion to failure inhibits. He ends up looking far more insecure and shaky than if he was not trying to present himself to the world. At the end of term, I called Peter and invited myself over. The reasons for this are manifold, but center on career-minded avarice. I wanted to work at the university where he was a guest lecturer, or at Stowe School where he had been head of English for 21 years. So I went over and was amusing and cheered the poor man up. He retired early to be a novelist, and his day-to-day existence was lonely. Note, later in our friendship, I edited his second novel for him and suggested that we collaborate on a book. This is, once again, my own ambition seeking to exploit Peter's vanity and his desire for companionship. Time passed. I saw Peter again and again. He once came to Olney, and I showed him around the various churches and spoke about the history of the Baptist Christian tradition in Britain, blah and blah. Typically, though, I would visit him during a free hour or two while I was in Buckingham anyway, and he would make us a meal. I had and still have a very clear model of relationships reciprocity, or mutuality, which is vulgarly commercial. He gives me things, and he gets me for a length of time. Historical example. He lets me stay in the spare room, makes me dinner and breakfast, and in exchange, he wins at chess and feels a little less lonely. This is needlessly cruel, of course. I do like the man and appreciate some of the things he's done for me. However, that's not really an interesting thing to say.
Needlessly cruel, Ben called it. And yet, he did more than just use Peter. He began abuse to add insult to injury. Ben and Martin, shrewd as they were, had devised a system through which they would glean much more than a furthering of career from not just Peter, but several targets whom they called clients in their plans. The execution of such a strategy was, as Ben said, needlessly cruel, but the goal was clear. Ben and Martin aimed to secure inheritances from pensioners in the regular Black Widow fashion, earning trust and becoming the named inheritors of estates of all sizes before ending the lives of the selected clients to cash in on their twisted plots or projects. The plans for ending each client's life were called exit strategies, and there was much more planning that went into this part of the scam as well. But for Ben and Martin, who had yet to cash in on their plan with a single person, turned their full attention on Peter, first to reap the rewards of their sick efforts. Ben and Martin had notes, some of which detailed methods of killing. And one of Ben's many ideas was to have Peter die an alcoholic's death. Ben even recorded a rap on his dictaphone, glorifying himself as he plots to kill the man he has claimed to love. So the two set to work in bringing about their plans. As Ben had become Peter's supposed partner and definite confidant, there was a question of Peter's last will and testament, which when it came up, was apparently left to Peter's brother, Ian. Peter, though, soon named Ben in his will instead, as the two underwent a betrothal ceremony in 2014. Peter believed that he would not have to worry about dying alone, and in a way, he was right. Ben went about a slow and cruel method for the eventual extrication of Peter from the ties of his life. Firstly, Ben began to drug Peter, taking apart Peter's own medications to add drugs of his choice into the mix. The initial changes were sudden. Peter began to notice that he felt more groggy than usual. He experienced hallucinations, and he felt less stable, one time sustaining serious injuries from a fall. But that wasn't all. Ben also took to moving things around Peter's home when Peter wasn't looking. These things would go missing frequently enough that Peter began to question his own sanity. And only when Ben came home would these items be miraculously found. Ian, Peter's brother, said later that these actions were robbing Peter of the things he held most dear, including his intellect. Since he now started to doubt his own work, Peter had also become less social and more inept in his usual intellectual environments. And in one case, he even experienced the psychoactive drugs to their utmost effect. The day in question was the day that he released his book, A Wide, Wide Sea, which Ben and Martin had encouraged Peter to publish. And yet, Ben was there, slipping him psychedelic 2CB to turn the man into a gibbering shadow of that which he once was. It made many students of his nervous, as people came from near and far to learn from Peter, whose quick wit was legendary to a local degree. And yet, although students and friends worried, Peter's trips to the doctors turned up nothing suspicious. It was as if nothing was out of the ordinary, medically speaking anyway. He had been hospitalized nonetheless for these episodes from April to September of 2015. But the doctors did not suspect or test for drugging. Not only did Ben slip Peter drugs, though, he encouraged Peter's drinking to exacerbate the issues that came of these drugs, and eventually he used the same drinking habit to convince Peter that he was unwell. Ben told Peter that he believed Peter had become an alcoholic, and Peter, whose vision had been blurred by attraction and by months of drugging, believed him. Peter, who was finding his crystal glass in the freezer and finding all his contacts deleted on his phone, firmly believed that his mind was simply going. At the hands of his lover, though, Peter was suffering a slower deterioration after the initial changes that left him listless, depressed, and devastated at the loss of that which he held dearest, his mind.
Not every student who maintained contact with Peter had sinister motives. One such former student, a man named Richard Searby, had been taught by Peter at Stowe in the 1980s. Richard Searby, among others, noticed the seemingly sudden shift to the doddery and confused state that Peter was in when the two in July of 2015 made a visit to the theater. There, Richard was saddened by the apparent loss of wherewithal that Peter was experiencing. But something didn't sit right with Richard. He had met Ben multiple times at Peter's home, and for Richard, something about the younger man was unnerving. In fact, during Richard's last visit to Peter's home in September 2015, the two were enjoying a walk around the house. Peter was still frail, but some time in a care home had significantly improved his condition. However, when Ben appeared, leaving the house to get something from the shops, there was that feeling of disquiet once again for Richard. Still, he finished up his visit with Peter, and he later left, driving through Buckingham, a nearby town where he noticed this guy following him. Same car that Ben left the house in. An eerie feeling encompassed Richard as he drove. He followed me to the edge of town and then turned away without waving or flashing his lights. The very next month, on October 3rd, Peter was hospitalized yet again, and his symptoms drove doctors to conclude he had overdosed on 14 tablets of flurazepam, a psychoactive drug which Peter was prescribed, as well as 400 milliliters of gin, a dangerous mixture that was sure to have massive repercussions. But Peter didn't remember taking those meds, and he assured the hospital attendants that he was not suicidal. It wasn't long before he was back in his own home, where he was assumed safe and sound. Until, that is, on the 26th of October, when Peter was found dead in his own home by the cleaner who came into his home. He sat dead on the sofa, next to his pills and whiskey bottle, and a glass. It seemed that he had done it again, and it was not assumed to be suspicious for most who knew not much of Peter's home life. Ian, though, had come and saw the glass and bottle where they lay next to Peter's spot on the couch, and felt as though something was amiss. Not an investigator, though, he soon dismissed the thoughts, as he had Peter's affairs to worry about. He went to have a talk with Ben, which he later described as unreal. It seemed that Ben was virtually unaffected by the catastrophic event at hand, and it wasn't just Ian that thought so. Richard, who eventually got to see his friend one last time at the funeral, got an even better look at Ben. He later told media, "At the funeral, I thought he was surprisingly lacking in grief. My wife and I commented at the time, we thought he was quite perky given the circumstances." Ben and Martin had gaslighted Peter, conspired to bring about mental anguish that causes a person to doubt their sanity. It was cruelly intended, and even as they brought about the man's death, they were able to glean from an inheritance of which Ben was left the lion's share. Peter trusted Ben implicitly, and in the shadows, Ben weaved destruction from the unknowing victim. In addition, the two young men set up a posthumously named company for Peter's unpublished works, hoping to release them for a profit. It was clear what had happened to many, but the doubt and suspicion would not motivate the police until months later. For now, Ben and Martin walked free to strike along their 100-person list of potential clients. But they didn't go far before beginning their next project. Ben Field, though, clever in matters of manipulation, was a cocky killer. Although he used the funds from Peter's inheritance to get a toaster apartment, he lacked the street smarts to know that it was a bad idea to take his dark game three doors down into the home of Ann Moore Martin. We will be right back after these short messages.
Anne was another person just Ben's type. Retired, unwed, with no children to speak of, and devout in her faith of Roman Catholicism. She was born in Kent, and her career as a Catholic schoolteacher took her from town to town all over England. After being appointed as headmistress at a Catholic primary school in Bicester, Oxfordshire, when she made this last move in her career, she made her home with her mother in Mains Morton, an attached home that was three doors down from Peter Farquhar. Anne, who was now in her 80s, felt a sense of surprise and wonder when Ben Field began writing to the retired head teacher. He paid regular visits to her home. He wrote poems, love letters, and other messages to this woman who lived just down the street from his previous mark. Little did she know, he was the reason for Peter's departure. She met Ben, sure, once he had moved in with the author. But nothing had explicitly implicated foul play initially. However, it wasn't as if the new relationship was considered a normal thing. Anne, who lived alone all her life, was a well-loved part of her own family. Auntie Anne, as they called her, wasn't just an aunt, but a mum, grandmother, an aunt, all rolled into one.
It was her nurturing spirit that made her family care so much for her. And when her relatives, especially her niece, Anne Marie Blake, learned of Ben's role in the woman's life, they grew suspicious. Ben, who was over 50 years her junior, was spending a lot of time wooing Anne. He said that he loved her, and soon he began to have a sexual relationship with her. One time, even taking photographs of her as she was engaging with him in sexual acts without her knowledge. Something Ben thought he could eventually use as blackmail, if need be. Ben knew how important Anne's religious background was to her, and it wasn't just something that he took to using as blackmail. Ben also took to writing so-called messages from God on the mirrors in Anne's home. These, like so many of the things that he did, were planned, written down, with many of them reading inspirationally, such as, "Your intentions are holy, your work is not yet done. Take care, and complete the task given to you by the Lord." Others too explicitly mentioned Ben and called to attention her relationship with him, such as, "Pray for Ben, Ben loves you. And all that you give him will return tenfold." Soon the messages had their way with the devout old woman, whose affections for Ben would not belie his true nature. They convinced her to change her will.
She was swooning for Ben, who had acted as a Christian himself. He had everyone fooled, and it wasn't just for the late payoff. Ben swindled Anne in life as much as he tried to do in death. Ben first fraudulently claimed that he was in desperate need of a car. For this, he eventually came to Anne, and Anne, encouraged into obscene generosity with Ben by the messages in her mirrors, gave the money needed to Ben. She gave him £4,000 sterling to use for this purchase, but she gave him even more later, when Ben approached her with a fake sob story involving his very real brother Tom. Tom and Ben both falsely claimed that Tom was experiencing kidney failure at an insanely quick rate, to the point where he required a dialysis machine of his own in order to function, on pain of death. Anne took this very seriously, and she took no issue with giving Ben another $27,000 in order to get help for his brother. Tom, who had been in on the take, knew of Ben's projects and had in fact called it good fun, only advising against the manipulation of these elderly people's last wills. It apparently mattered not what Ben did in life to extort and gaslight these unfortunate souls for whom generosity was obviously a common trait. It only mattered to Tom that Ben did not mess with the wills of these people, probably because the amount of attention such changes would likely receive in succession. Still, Tom and Ben were quite fine with taking the $31,000 from her that she gladly offered to help a dear friend. In fact, she made sure to call the bank and make it happen as soon as she could, as could be heard in the following phone call.
I'm just going to hand you over to Anne.
Hello. I'm thinking of withdrawing all my accounts, the money held in my accounts.
Okay.
At some time, because I have an urgent need for them. I have a very dear friend, mm-hmm. who's the brother of another very dear friend, and he's extremely ill. Mm-hmm. He's got very difficult kidney difficulties, mm-hmm. and is likely to die if he doesn't have his own dialysis machine and so on. I've been thinking of a way in which I can help him. He is a lovely young man, and he's got a lovely brother who's a bit older than him too. Mm-hmm. To stay alive, he actually has to have this dialysis machine.
Okay.
He's heartbroken because he can't continue at the moment. In life, one must not be selfish and keep everything to yourself. If this investment was worth it, I think it would be a great help for them.
After a message from God came to Anne telling her to leave her home to Ben, she began to have trouble sleeping. During this time, Ben apparently offered her a white powder, and the concoction he brought her seemed to help her sleep. It wasn't long, though, until the drugs that Ben was evidently bringing her made Anne fall terribly ill. When she did, she wound up in the hospital, where her niece Anne Marie accompanied and comforted her. It was then that Anne finally gained lucidity. She understood the nature of Ben's relationship with her a little better after discussing with Anne Marie that she had been receiving this white powder to sleep, but also that she had been finding these mysterious messages from God, which the two now suspected to be Ben's doing. Although Anne Marie said that Anne had trouble getting her mind around the betrayal, one thing was evident to Anne now. She had to change her will back. She was wrought with confusion. And Anne Marie came to the police with the suspicions that she had relaying the information about the evident drugging and the mirrors that had been speaking to Anne in her home. Anne, whose thoughts were finally clear once more, asked her niece shortly before her stroke a few weeks after her hospitalization, quote, "I'm such an intelligent woman. How could I let this happen to me?" End quote. In her will, Anne left her home and the rest of her estate, which totaled about $380,000, to Anne Marie, the same niece who stayed by her side in her last struggles against the cruel, calculating killer who had come for her money.
After his and Martin's arrests, Ben admitted to the manipulation and fraud. He admitted to gaslighting each of the victims. Peter Farquhar and Anne Moore Martin had been, without a doubt, swindled by this man and his accomplices, Martin and Tom, in ways that hadn't fully been realized until his confession. Ben had convinced all in the little village of Mains Morton that he was a Christian himself, a boy called into the service of the Lord. He was a Baptist preacher's son and a church warden. He even expressed ambitions to vicardom. He made a lie based around truths he knew, which is the easiest kind to get away with. Ben, for his part, believed that sharing these details of fraud would make him appear honest, and that the jury would buy his plea of innocence on the count of murder against him. When the investigation came down hard on the projects and the team behind them, though, not much stuck on anyone but Ben. Martin, who walked free of the murder charge, simply stated that he learned from the experience. "I'm relieved that this ordeal is finally over. The lessons I take from this case are first and foremost to always be your own person, and secondly, to always choose your friends very carefully." Tom, similarly, walked free of the charge against him for defrauding the late school teacher for the dialysis money. Ben, though, had concocted a defense for his crimes that didn't pan out. He admitted to his actions in gaslighting the two. saying of his work with Peter that he did it for no other reason other than it was cruel to upset and torment Peter, purely out of meanness. He loaded Peter up with drugs, lorazepam, hallucinogenics, bioethanol, and potine, in addition to the alcohol that he encouraged Peter to imbibe on a regular basis. He also was discovered to have looked up various horrific ways to torture his two targets, including online searches for information on injecting testicles with lactic acid and bleach enemas, two of the more cruel ways that he obviously was ruminating on as he did his evil deeds. His defense, based around telling only of his manipulation, nonetheless failed. He had intended to kill the pair, it was clear. He did not prove his so-called honesty to the court, and his cruel intentions simply solidified the reality before the court. Ben Field was a cold-blooded killer. The lead investigator for the case, as well as the prosecuting team, believed and proved that Ben had suffocated Peter after drugging him so potently that he'd given no resistance. They also believed that, given the chance, Ben would have most certainly become a serial killer, stalking and prowling for lonely people of old age, looking to torment them and then to get paid doing it. Anne was found to have died of natural causes, but she was still a victim of Ben's fraudulent activities. Ben didn't get stuck with the charge of conspiracy to murder or attempted murder of Anne, but he was found guilty of the murder of Peter Farquhar, with the jury taking 77 hours to reach the final verdict. Judge Justice Sweeney told reporters that it was, in fact, a challenging case, but in the end, the clarity of the issue brought forth their killer, Ben, who was sentenced to life in prison with a minimum of 36 years in 2018.
It's not known whether the fraud that Martin and Tom engaged in with Ben discontinued after Ben's sentencing. What is known is this: Ben was the evident mastermind in this plot, the ringleader of sorts, with notes and recorded conversations that led the police right to him as the principal actor in these crimes. The involvement of each other man was deplorable, but without more to go on, they walked free of the charges against them, while Ben began his life behind bars. Ben had made a life out of lying and manipulation, and when the truth came out, there were others who shared their stories of the man they thought they knew. BBC Radio 5 Live was able to produce a documentary on this life of Ben, which they called Killer in the Congregation. In it, one contact from Ben's earlier life shares her thoughts on the man who turned out to be a sadist and murderer. The following excerpt from the story helps to reveal the nature of Ben's deceit and to what lengths it had gone. Quote, Lucy, not her real name, had been friends with Field for a long time, and thought she knew everything about the man who made her laugh with his funny stories. But she admitted to BBC Radio 5 Live documentary Killer in the Congregation that the person I knew probably didn't ever exist. He was always a bit odd, she said, like lovable odd. The stories he told would make me laugh because he was always very good at observing people. When Field was charged with murder, Lucy wanted to believe he was innocent, but reading the evidence against him made her realize she didn't know him at all. I guess there's always a part of you that hopes it will turn out to be some weird joke, and then you see photographic evidence and you're like, oh God, she said, end quote.
There are dark deeds going on in every neighborhood, big or small, young or old. There are those who prey on children and those who prey on their peers. What's evident here is that people also prey on those who have lived their lives. Those who have a plethora of years behind them, simply looking for peace and a reason within the twilight of their days. And those people, just like everyone else, deserve justice. They deserve the ability to live as unfearing citizens in what should be a warm, cozy existence. but the world is cold. And although we have friends and family that live in it, the world is also shared by predators. Some cunning, some stronger than us, and some most definitely hiding in sheep's clothing. When we've reached the end of the road to discover it's a trap, it's these predators, these people devoid of moral conduct, that take from us until there's nothing left but a heap, a shell of our former selves. It's in this position that Peter and Anne's families found them, thanks to the work of Ben and his accomplices. And it's thanks to Ben and others like him, prowling the homes of the lonely and helpless, that we have to sleep restlessly at night, unsure of what's really out there. Because of these people, we can never really know what people are like. Not really.
Hey, Devil We Know fans. I wanted to share with you another band to pique your interest. Meet Just a Mess, a local band that plays at a plethora of places in the Chicago area. In fact, Thursday, November 21st, is another show of theirs at Roscoe's in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. The show is around 8 p.m. that night, so head on over to hear them play. You won't regret it. Their song, Manifest Destiny, has been quite the hit and made it onto YouTube as the band's first official music video. Here's a sneak peek at their rock and sound, and if you like what you hear, follow the link in the show notes to find them on Spotify. So without further ado, Just a Mess, playing Manifest Destiny.
Biting my lips till they turn blue, bashing my head in spite of you. Just keep excited, you're in my head. Keep thinking about the day in your bed. Just one more year. I can't forget this. Nothing but your bliss.
The new intro we played was produced and created by Chase Gray from Chase Multimedia. I want to give a huge shout out to Chase. He does phenomenal work, super talented guy. More importantly, super nice guy. So thank you, Chase. Please go to devilweknowpodcast.com for support of the show. You can buy merch there and donate any amount of money to the show. Just a one-time donation would help. You can also join our Patreon at patreon.com/devilweknowpodcast, where you can get 2 minisodes a month for $1. It's a pretty good deal. You also get some stickers. I would like to give a huge shout out to our new Patreon member, Dia. Thank you so much for joining and being a part of our family. And until next week, stay safe. Sources: the Thames Valley Police, Harry Shookum and David Brown of the Times, Bill Gardner of the Telegraph, Joe Black and Vicky Farncombe of BBC Radio 5 Live, BBC News, Rod Minchin of Independent, Jess Glass of the Metro UK, John Twomey of Express, Martin Fricker and Adam Aspinall of the Free Library, Stephen Naismith of the Herald, Thomas Bamford of the Bucks Herald, Emma Moden of The Guardian, and Mike Smalcolm of Cornwall Live.